Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. A large crowd today for a selection of four bills. Quality crowd. That's a good point. We go for quality over quantity in this hearing room, at least for today. So we'll start with the public hearing on House Bill 3171. Zach, you can give us a quick summary.
House Bill 3171 extends the sunset for the manufacture of water transit vessels to an unspecified date.
Thank you. As befits our process with respect to the sunset review, we are going to we'll have this bill open to consider this tax credit. We don't have anyone who has signed up to hear the bill. Is that correct? So that suggests, at least to me, that tax credit may not have a long life beyond its sunset. Is there anyone who would like to be heard on House Bill 3171? I don't see any. So unless the committee would like to say anything about the bill, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3171. And open a public hearing on House Bill... On House Bill 3174, please.
Yeah. House Bill 3174 extends tax credits for certain research activities to an unspecified date.
Thank you. I think we do have some people who want to be heard on this bill. I'm guessing, Mr. Craven, you might be among them. The list is making its way to us. Thank you. And you are on this one. You, the pair, Mr. Craven and Ms. Weiser.
Like revenue the other day.
There's some overlap, isn't there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Craven, and I represent a national trade association called Tech America, which is the nation's largest trade association representing the high-tech industry, with about 100-plus members here in Oregon. We're here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 3174, which is an extension of the state's research and development tax credit. While there's no specific sunset date in the printed bill, we would suggest a six-year extension in line with previous actions by this assembly, but of course that will all, I guess, be part of the broad Joint Committee on Tax Credit decisions making later in the session. The Oregon Research and Development Tax Credit is quite simple. It uses determinations and formulas that are housed in the Internal Revenue Code, so it basically piggybacks on top of a federal credit. In Oregon, it's a 5% of your investments that are subject to the Oregon Research and Development Tax Credit. The federal credit has a core metric, and that is that in order to qualify, the company must increase its investments in R&D over a base year investment. So in other words, it is designed, in a sense, to work because it's rather than being an entitlement, it actually is an incentive that encourages companies to increase their spending over time. Since the passage of this credit in 1989 by this assembly, Oregon has made tremendous strides in becoming a research and innovation economy. There is a wonderful website, any of you who love data, sponsored by the National Science Foundation. It's called Engineering Education Indicators, and it's just a voluminous list of metrics about all the states and federal government in terms of education. You can look up to see how your state's doing on educating engineers. You can look up how your state is doing in investing in research and development, both at the private and public sectors. Some of that data is in the printed testimony. I won't read it, other than to say in a couple comparisons. In 1998, Oregon's investment in R&D as a percentage of gross domestic product was 77% of the U.S. average. In 2007, we were at 105% of the U.S. average. Most of that research in Oregon is done by the private sector. Some of it's done within higher education. But Oregon businesses spent on R&D in Oregon, $1.3 billion in 1998, rising to $3.6 billion in 2007. And why is research spending important in your state economy? Well, research drives innovation, development of new products, and research-intensive jobs are generally much higher paid than average jobs. In the high-tech sector alone, we've seen payoff in both in employment and wages. According to Tech America, we do an annual survey of the 50 states on a host of data called Cyber States U.S. We have 86,000 people in Oregon working in the high-tech sector with an average wage of $80,000. That's 104% of the average private sector wage in Oregon. So in a state that is highly dependent, as you all know, on the personal income tax, growing high-wage jobs that are taxed at either 9 or up to 11% per year is a good strategy to help generate necessary funds to fund public services. But the R&D tax credit is not limited to what you would call high-tech alone. It's applicable to a broad set of sectors, including food processing, wood products, especially metals, and a host of others. So it is an incentive that's broadly available to Oregon businesses. Well, certainly we're not going to come here today and argue that all of that tremendous research and all that innovation and research in Oregon is due to the existence of this credit alone. But it is part of the mix that makes Oregon an attractive state in which to do this kind of work. Our quality of life obviously is part of it. Other tax incentives is part of it. Our increasingly better higher education system is part of it. 40 states have some form of incentive that encourages research and development. Some states recently have doubled down. In last year, Minnesota doubled the value of their research incentive and also made it refundable, meaning even if you don't have taxable income, the state will actually refund you the money. Now, we're not asking for that here today, but just to give you an idea of what some states are doing. About an hour ago, I got an email that said Governor Christie in New Jersey has proposed to the New Jersey Assembly to double the research and development tax credit in that state. So the trend is basically towards making this a more valuable incentive at the state level. Oregon's 5% is about mid-range among the 40 states. There's a table at the back of the testimony that shows you the states and their ranges. They range from an effective rate of about 0.2% to as high as 20% in some states. So just two sort of key facts that it is a credit that is based upon accelerating your spending. So in terms of efficiency and does the credit work, the credit is only given on a backward-looking basis, so you have to actually do what the credit is designed to do before you get the credit. It's not one of these things where some kind of tax credit is given and then we kind of hope for the best. So that's, I think, one key factor. And the other factor is that in the Oregon credit, it is also available for private sector contributions to institutions of higher education. So as we do a lot of in Oregon, Oregon companies that sponsor research at Oregon State University or University of Oregon, Portland State, those donations are actually subject to the research and development tax credit in Oregon. So it's a separate wrinkle that we enjoy here in the state. I believe you'll have, I don't know if Legislative Revenue Office is bringing the substantive committee's revenue impact statements. I think on the latest chart we've seen in the House Revenue Committee, extension of this credit in the next biennium will cost $1.9 million and $7.4 million for a full extension in the following biennium.
Exactly right. That's what I have in front of me, and 12.1 for the 15-17 biennium.
Okay. So at least we're working off the same database because those charts keep changing.
Yep.
Real quick, I know I'm not sure if you've gone through the tax credit drill in this committee yet, but we have the 8 questions, and I've tried to answer them very briefly on page 3. Let me just hit a couple highlights. I don't want to go through them one by one, but we've talked about the purpose and timeline. We've talked about who benefits. What happens if it sunsets? Could it be scaled down? I mean, you can always scale things down. We wouldn't encourage you to do that. But just to point out that we are not the most robust among the states in this kind of incentive. We can't predict what would happen if there was a 50% cut. All I know is that from the companies I've talked to, both large and small, they've all highlighted this as something that makes Oregon a more attractive place to do this kind of work. Question four, what background is available from other states? You have a chart that shows the status of these in the 40 states that use them. Question five, is the credit effective and efficient? I touched on this earlier, that it's efficient in the sense that you only get this credit if you do what you have to do to get the credit. In other words, it's not a front-loaded thing that relies upon a promise. It's actually you have to deliver before your company is available to get this credit. Because it is based upon a federal set of rules and regulations, it's efficient in the state of Oregon. There's not an administrative overburden. We don't have a bunch of state agency people that have to evaluate all this. There really are a couple different kinds of tax issues. There are tax things that are on your return subject to audit, such as most of our personal tax expenditures. We don't apply to government, ask for them. They are embedded in the tax code and subject to you being honest on your tax return. There are other kinds of credits we do, such as the one that I'm not supposed to use the name of anymore, that one that's really three credits, has to do with energy efficiency. That's a different kind of credit where you actually apply on a form and you get either, government says yes or no. So there are different kinds, R&Ds, the prior. What other incentives are available to achieve a similar policy goal? We do a certain amount of sponsored program work in Oregon. The good work that Oregon Inc. does, for example, is an example of you allocate a chunk of money in the Oregon Inc. process, targets research into some buckets, and that's a great program also. This program allows the company to make its own choices about which direction they want to go and how they want to innovate and get an incentive to do so. So those are just some of the quick answers to the list of questions, and I'm going to wrap up and be happy to answer any of your questions.
I think we will undoubtedly have some questions, but let's hear from Ms. Weiser first.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So we think that research and development should be encouraged by the state, and we think that this is probably not the best mechanism that we have for doing it. We don't know who gets this tax credit. The information is known at the Department of Energy by whoever happens to be auditing a particular firm's forms. Whether
did
that
you mean to say Department of Revenue?
Department of Revenue, yes, excuse me. But it doesn't. But we don't know beyond that, so we really can't know what kind of research is being done, what kind of jobs are being created, or how effective it's being for our state. The primary beneficiaries are large established businesses, according to the research data from our own department. And GAO reports question the value of this as a federal tax credit and as a state tax credit. The bottom of my page gives the document source that says that most of this research would have gone on anyway, and so we're really just subsidizing what a business has to do in order to survive. Obviously, our big companies would not continue to be big companies if they didn't stay abreast of developments and didn't keep changing what they produce. And so they need to do it in any case. The criteria for this tax credit are pretty odd. It's based upon what were you doing back in 1984 through 88, and then have you increased your research and development since then. If you didn't exist back then it's a different period of time that's more recent. Have you increased your research and development dollars? Well, obviously, if you're doing the same amount of research, you're going to be spending more by now than you were then, just because the cost of doing business has gone up.
And by those, are you talking about the federal criteria?
Yes, according to the federal criteria.
Okay. Thank you.
So we believe that the model for research and development in the BEPSI program, which is the spreadsheet that you have, is a better model because you know what you're doing. You can look and see what companies you're helping support. Your model.
I just have to pause for a moment. Did I hear you correctly arguing that the BEPSI was a good model?
I think that the model for research and development in the BEPSI is a better model than the research and development under the qualified research activities.
I'll let that sink in for myself. go ahead, please.
And part of the reason is you have before you a list of the the businesses that we have subsidized. You'll notice that most of them are not names that are common household names because they're mostly startups, companies that actually don't have the resources to do the research and development work that we assume big companies like Mentor and Intel and Nike all have. You know, they have the capacity to fund their own research, whereas newer companies do not. And we think that it makes sense that if you're going to subsidize research, you should not care whether the business is a C corp or an LLC or a partnership. And the qualified research is only available to C corps. So you're really disqualifying many of the businesses in our state from being available, having this benefit available to them. So if you took the model that is in the BETSI program where we have government employees who actually look at what is being proposed and is this research that we want to support, we have the ability to cap it. We have the ability to watch to see what's happening. You don't need to only do green businesses. You know, certainly not. That's why I said we like the model, but you would expand it to include other kind of businesses. And you get some choice in how much goes to any one business because the government is in charge instead of the business being in charge of what the government subsidy is for that particular business. And we think that not only should we expand that model to be more broadly available for different kinds of businesses, but we also think that the tax credit model is kind of silly because most of these businesses, including the research and development tax credit, they don't have a tax liability to use it. And so it should be a grant, a loan, better yet a loan, because then you've got a clawback if they don't perform and create the kind of jobs and the kind of research that you were expecting them to do, or a real venture capital investment. When you look at some of the companies on this list, we've actually provided a lot of the capital for some of these companies, and we don't have an ownership interest like other venture capitalists would have, and the state could be doing that as part of its give with some of these beginning companies.
Thank you very much. I have a few questions too, but I bet some others do. Representative Lindsay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this credit started in 89, and actually I have a few questions if that's all right, Mr. Chair. It started in 89. How many extensions have been granted and for how much, Jim? How much time?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lindsay, having been present at the creation, my first session lobbying was 1989 on behalf of Tech America, then AEA. I think it has gone in sort of six-year cycles. I know, obviously, there's been a couple of extensions. I would have to go back and look, but I don't believe it's ever been, it's always had a sunset. And I don't believe it's ever been more than 6 years, so we could probably count those six-year tranches, and that would give you your answer.
Okay, thanks. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
And I understand that it's a qualified research, qualified meaning that it must be done in Oregon. Has there been any sort of abuse? Being a lawyer, I know we're always looking for loopholes. Has there been any sort of abuse on research done out of state and getting the credit? Is there any evidence of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, not that I have ever heard or even seen alleged, or I do not know of any example like that.
Okay, and then final question is there any sort of quantitative measurement for us to value the return on investment for these credits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, not probably in exact form, just as there aren't on many tax provisions that are part of the code rather than, apply and grant. I mean, there are different ways that we do incentives. This one is done. It's self-directed in the sense that it's, companies make the choices about where to make their investment subject to all the provisions and the regulations of the tax code. But because it's not one where you ask permission and receive permission and get a stamp of approval, it doesn't quite fit that other model.
I want to pick up a little bit on a distinction I heard you make in your testimony, both of you, about the self-directed versus directed nature of the two models that are here. And I can see some advantages to both. So maybe I'd like to hear you both say something about that. Ms. Weiser, on your point, I can see some advantages to having some alignment and strategy across various things, but I can also see some real disadvantages if the wise people at the in various parts of government pick the wrong thing or are not aware of things that a proprietary sort of company can identify as promising. So I'd like to hear how you feel about that as a criticism of the notion. And Mr. Craven, thinking about how we try to build on the competitive advantages of Oregon, that things that might be uniquely suited to happening in Oregon as opposed to somewhere else. So is there merit to that kind of distinction? Where do you all come down on that kind of?
Well, Mr. Chair, I sort of raised that distinction partly to provide some context that I don't think it's an either or that there's a choice. I mean, that one is right and one is not right. I think nothing wrong with a kind of Oregon Inc. model where the state puts together a group of smart people and sort of says, we have a limited amount of funds, we would like to roll the dice in these directions, and parcels out, quite frankly, a fairly small amount of money at the end of the day to do those projects, most of which are consortia type of approaches, intentionally, the signature research type of approach, the food processing education approach. So they're, in a way, the state kind of supporting more of a trade association approach to addressing a problem, as opposed to basically saying, we want companies in Oregon that are innovating, and, you know, at the end of the day, you have to be nimble and you have to make your choices about where you want to innovate. Quite frankly, government can be a little slow in terms of convening these large processes and sort of getting to yes, and in the meantime, product cycles come and go. New products get introduced and become obsolescent sometimes in the time it takes to put together the consortium, build the signature research center, get it funded, and all that. So I guess my point would be both models have value, and I'm not sure that I would support a model. I'm just writing some notes here from my colleague up here about, you know, that it should all be government's choice, that government should pick in all cases where companies should focus their innovation dollars. Sometimes you want to say, we want to be an innovation state, and the kind of companies that do that work, we welcome that you are here, and we'll provide a modest incentive to do so, but you're the people who need to go innovate. And you not need to wait for us to convene the processes to approve which way you should innovate. That's just my opinion.
Thank you. Ms. Weiser?
So I think that my first response is that most of those companies that we think of are already doing that, and this is just something they get added. When I've talked to smaller company business managers and owners and asked, do you use this? They said, no, I'm not the right business type, or, you know, that's for big businesses, but because it's paperwork intensive, and you've got to be set up to, that's how you're doing it. We kept records for a year, and we decided it wasn't worth it to us. We got, you know, that kind of, it's 5% of our cost. And so it's that kind of response from smaller businesses. But also, that windfall effect is there for these businesses who are going to, we're not going to help Intel figure out what research they should do. They are excellent at doing that. That's why they're the successful company they are. And so so actually for us to give them a tax break is just to pat them on the back for doing what they were going to do. And that isn't the most powerful use of our limited tax dollars. If we're going to help businesses, then shouldn't we be helping the businesses that wouldn't be able to do their research if they weren't getting help?
Do you see any difference between that and whether Intel, I agree with you, Intel is going to do innovation as part of their business model, but we were thrilled, of course, that they chose to do some significant construction in Oregon, but they're also doing that in other places. Do you think this plays any role in where they're choosing to do the innovation that they do?
Well, if they're doing a new fab, it's not about this research money.
Just an example of where they're choosing to invest.
To the degree to which a company makes that kind of decision is and this amount of money would make a difference to them, I think would be really insignificant. We're not 5% of their research costs above a certain level with a cap is not a whole lot. They're not going to get their researchers to move from here to Arizona because they can get $2 million for the tax break there that they can't get here. So I don't think we're going to lose that kind of thing. I think there are many other reasons for why a business locates, and this is such a minor amount for a big company like Intel or Nike or Columbia, and they're all doing research. They have to. They can't come out with a new product line without having done some research. And so I don't think that's going to make their decisions. But that's me guessing, and it's their side claiming. And they have become adept. I mean, there's one bill before this House this year that says that in order to get this money, you have to sign a form that said you wouldn't have done what you're going to do without the tax break. Well, that doesn't make it true just because they signed that piece of paper. Just that was one of the pieces of paper they had to sign.
I don't think you hear anyone here claiming that.
Mr. Chair, I do want to point out that because people know that I work on this issue, somehow a number of small businesses started sending me letters over the weekend. I think your staff has them. You should see them in your folder. There are small businesses who said this made a difference and allowed me to hire two new people last year. This is not just a big business issue. I don't even know these three companies. I did not, encourage those letters, but they come from Bend and Brooks and Portland, from small little shops who take advantage of this credit. So I just wanted to put that on the record. I think you do have copies of those in your folders.
We do. Thanks for pointing that out. Representative Smith?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Jim, my question is similar to the question several of us had when we're looking at these generally, and it is sort of the causation question, and the old the annoying Latin term, after which, therefore, because of which, and which isn't really the case.
Ergo pro poster hoc, something like that.
So do we have anything more than since this happened, they've done this to be able to do some version of economic analysis over the multiplier we're getting, over the impact we're getting, versus using that same, $2, $7, $12 million in a different way, or structuring the tax credit a little bit differently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, individual company analysis, is that what you're getting at? Or
a way to do, I'm wanting to get at the cause. I haven't heard the thing yet that helps me understand how we're evaluating the causal impact of this tax credit to the results that have happened in the world and that we like. And I will also say, in terms of this or research and development arena, I do think this is a place where government can play, right? I do think it is a place where, and I might have a question on that, but I mean sort of causation generally, what do we know other than post hoc ergo propter hoc?
It's good to know that it's hoc, not hoc.
It's either way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. It was a whole West Wing episode with that as a title.
I know. So I know it, really.
Yeah,
I didn't
that's
pay
all
attention.
I
didn't pay attention to law school. I just
exactly. It is a good question, and the answer is probably a little bit difficult. And I'll just be very frank about that, of trying to aggregate all these up. We have the same challenge with a whole host of tax expenditures, as you know. It doesn't necessarily mean they're not the right thing to do. It means, for instance, do we have data that says people wouldn't buy homes if they didn't have a mortgage tax deduction? Do we have data that says people wouldn't contribute to charity if we didn't have a charitable tax deduction? Mm-hmm. These are, they're difficult things to do that kind of analysis with, mm-hmm. admittedly. Not just this one. whole bunch of them, and that's partly what we're trying to wrestle with this session. What I can bring you is primarily anecdotal, primarily feedback from my member companies and other companies that I've spoken to in Oregon. Those companies are not always willing to sit in this chair and talk about their profit loss statement and make, you know, I will add 3.4 jobs and I promise to do that, and if I don't, you can claw it back from me. So some of that is difficult to do that analysis. I know that people over the years have said at various different stages that things that we're doing for incentives, well, people do, they'll do it anyway. There are big facilities in this state, such as Intel, such as Genentech, such as many other companies, who are here because you took, as an assembly, bold action to provide incentives and encourage the kind of behavior you want to encourage. And I think that's where we get down on some of these. Is it a I can prove you exactly the outcome, or is it you're the kind of company doing the kind of things that we want to encourage in Oregon, and here's a modest encouragement to do so. So,
thanks. You have a follow-up? Yeah, a couple of follow-ups. For the record, and forgive this kind of basic question, but can you just say for the record why, and Ms. Weiser, if you want to amplify this, that's fine too, because you made a comment that was germane. Why is R&D an area that we ought to invest in, intervene in, help in? Why is this an area that the market doesn't just sort of figure out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think why does the state want to encourage this kind of behavior and activity? I think at the bottom line, it comes down to things that you want to encourage, which is the growth of high-wage jobs. You want to encourage companies to do their research in Oregon as opposed to doing it other places, because when a company such as an Intel anchors their research in Oregon, they anchor their company in Oregon, and as opposed to being just another site among the many states where they do something, being the state where they do the main thing they do is important, and then you create those high wage jobs and then you get 9-11% of it. So That's my answer.
Please, I want to try again on that one. So I get why we want R&D, for sure, and I get why we want high-wage jobs, for sure, and I get why we want it to be competitive in the innovation economy, for sure. And I understand to some degree why, if to some degree, sort of state competitiveness, right? If you know, if our neighbor's doing it, we need to do it, and therefore we got to, you know, we got to run fast in that race. Is there anything beyond racing with neighbor states to say that, well, this is an area of where you know, my view of government, not, you know, is that we should do the things that aren't going to happen anyway, right, that need to happen, right? The government shouldn't play where it doesn't need to play. And so we should play in areas of market failure, right? So why is R&D an area of market failure, right? Why is that a place where the market just doesn't figure it out?
Okay, now I get it. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think that's it is a really good question, and I think it's a question that we can ask, you know, about a lot of other things we do as to whether markets are perfect. We do live in a very competitive environment. I mean, I'm sure you have people from economic development world who come before you all the time and point that out to you about, you know, arrows in the quiver and competitive advantages and being part of that. I hate to call it a game, but it is a very serious game in terms of competition among the 50 states for economic development. Perhaps in a perfect market world, none of that would be required, and capital would go to where other competitive advantages exist, except the fact that it is a competitive world. And my personal opinion is that you know, you can choose to play, you can choose not to play, and you can accept the consequences. I think Oregon has chosen to play in some very targeted ways over the last 20 years. The strategic investment program, whatever you think about that thing that does energy efficiency, it has created certain things to happen in Oregon because we played in that realm. So that's about the best I can do, is that we don't live in a world of perfect markets.
Last comment.
Go ahead.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah, just say, so again, I don't, quite the contrary do I want to pick on research development. I actually think that there are real legitimate reasons why, you know, players in the market trying to compete for tomorrow have a hard time being motivated to compete from 10 years from now, and there is sort of, you know, collective advantage to us playing for 10 years from now. That's one of the reasons why we could be stronger together than we are apart. So I don't take issue with R&D. I do think it's helpful for us to keep it in mind, and frankly really do want it just sort of on the record and for us to be thinking about. For my part, I will be more, to the extent it's relevant, more comfortable with each of these as we come better to grips with tools to evaluate, reevaluate, eliminate, amplify, reduce, reform. As we get a more robust set of tools, it makes re-upping the ones we have feel much more prudent. And so I'll offer that, and would be really interested if you and our members come up with ideas. What if we tried this? We might be able to make the cause for causation, the case for causation, even better. If we did this, it might even be able to be more highly leveraged. If we did this, it might be more strategic. I don't have those answers, but honestly, would welcome them.
Okay. Appreciate that.
And Representative Smith, that is a good summation of what our task is. If we're to move this bill on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, it is those sorts of suggestions that I think is in our charge to consider. So the assignment goes to you too.
I'll delegate it to somebody else next time.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Craven, my question is, we're dealing with the sunset here on R&D. R&D usually doesn't produce a lot of jobs. Manufacturing does. Dealing with the high-tech companies and stuff, the Intel and places like that, and looking actually at your own chart, I mean, if I'm doing R&D, there's a lot better states. Hawaii would be a great place, and if I was an R&D guy, I'd love to be there on the beach doing my R&D. So, and looking at some of the other states. So I see us a little bit of a player in that world, but I wonder, would it be something for us to sit down and consider now moving this money towards more manufacturing and pulling the manufacturing? Let the R&D guys spend their time in Hawaii, but once they come up with a product that's deliverable, we manufacture it here, because that's really where the jobs are, is on the manufacturing side. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I guess I would take, not issue, but so a few things we know about Oregon's economy. One, it has historically been a very solid manufacturing economy. Part of the wrestling we've done the last 20 years is the loss of some of those jobs. I think in today's economy, where innovation is so much part of the product life cycle and such, that it requires both. It requires the innovation and then bringing the innovation to the factory to make the new innovative product. It would be great if Oregon excelled in both, and we have historically. And if you look at the example of Intel, not to just keep mentioning that company, but Intel is one of the most innovative companies in the world, and also manufactures here in Oregon and in other sites. But it innovates here and manufactures here and then manufactures other places. Same is true of some of our wood products companies, where, you know, that used to be you did the same thing decade after decade, and now it's oriented strand board and it's new innovative products. I mean, I would like to see us innovate and manufacture here. I agree with you that, but so often that innovation needs to be close to the factory floor. I mean, people need to be able to innovate and prove that they can make something at the same time. So I'd hate for those innovators all to go to the beach in Hawaii. I'd like to keep them here in Oregon, along with robust factories to make the stuff they come up with.
Hello? If I may?
Sure.
So from what I'm hearing is probably a direction I would lean a little bit myself. We should match Hawaii and focus on manufacturing, the two together, hand in hand.
Other questions, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there are a few points that have been brought up this afternoon that I want to explore just a little more. The thing about windfall, which is the effect of, well, they would have done it anyway, we're just basically changing their tax rate in a way. We're just changing how much tax a company's going to pay. So that, I think there's been enough said that it's just for us to mull over for a while. Although I do take note of its the Federal Government Accounting Office that came up with the analysis. That's a pretty venerable organization that does careful research. The things I want to explore a little more are, one, there's a statement here in the Tax Fairness Oregon document that mentions how this thing is calculated. It really got my attention when you said 1984 to 88. How does that compare to reality now? This just seems so off target. But then it said, for businesses that didn't conduct research for at least 3 years in that time period, 3% of average receipts over the last 4 years. So that's like a few decades later, but it's based on more current reality, if you will. So I'd like to hear a little bit about why is it a good idea to base it on 84 through 88, and why is it a good idea or not a good idea to base it on an average receipts over the last 4 years? That's one of the things I'm interested in hearing about. Another is I really noticed...
Maybe we should do them one at a time.
Okay, good.
At least for me, I don't get lost. Yeah, I think that's
will there be time for a subsequent?
So. Sure.
Good, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, my understanding, the federal credit was passed in 86. We followed fairly closely thereafter. The idea was to say that you needed to accelerate and up your ante. So the original law goes into effect, set original base, to say compare against. So it wasn't just you do the same thing year after year after year and you get a tax break. It was to compare investments compared to a base. That's why there's that old date, because it's an old law. And it's also why that if you started your company 10 years ago, you don't have to compare your R&D investments to your base in 1984, because you didn't exist, as you well point out. So that's why. So there's both a moving target and then a base for established companies that were in existence when the credit first went into federal law.
So in essence, the 1984 and 1988 is completely irrelevant now, even for companies that did exist then, because of a rolling comparison point?
Mr. Chair, I'll have to check out the nuances of that and report back to you.
It sounds like that's what is intended. Is that right?
I understand that's just the intent. I'll try to get some exactly how it works data for you.
And maybe then to amplify Representative Nathanson's question, would there be advantage to creating our own criteria separate from the federal criteria?
Mr. Chair, certainly. You know, sky's the limit this session on these conversations. Having been present in 1989 when this was first put into law, the reason was to make it simple and efficient, yes, and not to put another burden of separate set of tests for Oregon. That was the original rationale, and when this has been brought up, that's been the rationale, but it doesn't mean it has to be the rationale.
Thank you. My second question is... it didn't sound so good to me when I heard that many businesses are not eligible because it applies to only C-Corp, if I heard that right. And if I did hear it right, I know that another part of the testimony said it's not just big businesses, it's small businesses too. But why is it a good thing to offer this kind of a credit, if you're going to do it at all, only to C-Corps? Is that good policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I'll poke around a little bit on that and get back to you. I mean, there's a lot of tax expenditures that are designated in Section 317 or whatever, the ORS, that apply to C-Corps because they do it by reference to the code. But that doesn't mean it's the only way it could possibly be structured. It has been from its beginning and is today a corporate tax incentive. If you moved it to S-Corps or partnerships, then it would be an individual tax incentive. Doesn't mean that wouldn't be good or bad. It's just, I think that's the way it's been structured. But part of what we're doing this session is questioning premises. So,
that's a good question.
And I do want to question it, because since the 80s, businesses do business differently maybe they used to be a C corp and people now realize they don't want to be a C corp for one reason or another, and there's something else. The world is just too different in the decades that have intervened, and I want to find out why that's still a good idea. Maybe it was a great idea then. I wonder, is that still the way to do it now? And then finally, on the point of if you're creating high-wage jobs, the kind of R&D, the research jobs, or the more higher-level jobs, if you're creating those in Oregon, yes, we're getting the income tax revenue from that. However, if we had used that money to leverage federal dollars that come in for something else, we would be getting revenue paid on either revenue paid on jobs created from the matching federal money, or federal money just circulating in Oregon has a value to it also. So I guess I want to hear a little bit about, with the investments that we're asked to place in higher ed to try to stimulate research and development and other activity, we're putting dollars into higher ed, or asked to put dollars into higher ed for R&D. We're asked to also put dollars into the private sector, but those dollars could have been spent on something else that leveraged federal money. So do the dollars you're talking about here, do they leverage any federal money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, a project that I've been involved with, along with you, members of this body, since 1997, a project called ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council. This body has invested several million dollars into that engineering science initiative within higher education. That has leveraged from private sector, mainly from my member companies, more than a 2-to-1 match since 1997 in the public dollars that have been invested. So one could argue that by allowing companies to hang on to a little bit of their money, they have more money to do those kinds of public-private partnerships. Yes. The private sector in Oregon has greatly expanded its giving into higher education innovation stuff since this body got serious and said, we will put money into that initiative and we expect that match. And that match has come in more than 2-to-1 since 1997, since the beginning of that program. So we have a host of ways to address this. You have direct spending into higher ed that leverages both federal research dollars and private dollars in Oregon. We have companies doing their own innovation, getting some tax incentive to do so. So, I think it's there are multitudes of ways to do this. But we have in Oregon, with your support in this assembly, we have stepped up. All the talk about the gloom and doom of higher ed, and it's real, but we have done a heck of a job in the last 15 years, at least in this sector, in building higher education resources at our major institutions. And a lot of that progress has come from private sector giving to those institutions.
Thank you.
Thank you. So you mentioned that we're sort of midway on the scale where we are among the states who use this. And you mentioned good results or comparisons between spending and that sort of thing over the period of time. How do the results or the changes in the state rank us amongst the other states who are using it?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I may have asked that in a fairly incomprehensible way. If we're midway on the rate that we're giving and the generosity of our credit and so on, where are we on that same scale when comparing the results?
Mr. Chair, I understand your question. I think with the NSF website, I could probably pick my way through it and do that.
It's a precursor to another more general question, right, which might be easier to answer, and I apologize for putting you on the spot about data. What do you think, I'm guessing, and both of you have said this in different ways, that this is one factor, not necessarily the only factor. What are the things would you point to as important when corporations, be they C or S or other types, are considering where their R&D takes place?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the traditional answers to that are a combination of tax policy, higher education investments, overall quality of life, certainly K through 12 and those things. You've certainly seen out in Washington County the combination of a number of those factors. Yeah, we have done some aggressive tax incentive programs in Oregon, and I think they have paid off in spades, in big ways. Again, despite a lot of the naysayers about our higher education system in Oregon, we have stepped it up. Portland State is one of the leading institutions that Intel hires from, and Intel doesn't hire people, you know, they're pretty competitive in terms of who they can pick and choose from. Portland State's become a huge partner for that institution, as well as Oregon State and U of O. So we certainly were having a big conversation this session about that we need to do more for higher education in this state. We have pushed the ball forward, though. So I think it's a matter of, you know, that sort of amorphous quality of life component that we all talk about. What are the pieces of that? But I think we have done good job in higher ed in certain fields, and we've done good job of providing tax incentives, and we've I think moved the ball forward. And it's certainly the evidence is right out there in front of us. Despite our kind of gloomy economy, there are these pockets of growth and investment in Oregon that are being made by people who have lots of choices and have chosen Oregon.
So I want to comment. We have we've started helping quite a few new companies in that green economy to do manufacturing in this state. And they are companies, by and large, or a few local ones, but by and large, the manufacturers are sending their manufacturing here. They are not sending their research and development here. Their headquarters remains in Menlo Park or in Denver or in Seattle, and the manufacturing's coming. So this by itself is not shifting the who's where. You know, they started their business where they started it, and investors in California get people to move their business to California because they can give them that kind of human infrastructure there that isn't available here. But, you know, those Betsy dollars for manufacturing have not moved the research and development up. This isn't a tax credit that's going to do that. Because people start their businesses, as some of you heard me opine the other day, they start their business where they are.
We're talking about the R&D tax credit. Huh? I thought we were talking about the R&D tax credit.
Right. But I'm saying if you look at what businesses do, they don't just move their manufacturing, their R&D. They can move their manufacturing. They'll place it in various places. But they don't tend to move the research and development stuff very far because they've started where they were. And the movement that we've seen is from here to California, not the other way around.
Any other questions? Let's see. Thank you very much. We will have more to say, I suspect, on this, and certainly be interested in what other details you find, Mr. Craven, and the committee. It would be my hope that we can return to this question without too much delay and consider whether we'd want to move this bill towards the tax credit committee with whatever policy and structural changes we want to consider. So,
thank you
very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3174? Just someone passing by in the door that chooses not to. So with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3174 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3172.
House Bill 3172 extends the tax credit for electronic commerce in an enterprise zone to an unspecified date.
Thank you. The next in our series of tax credit extensions. Let's see if anyone would like to be heard on that. Ann Hannison, Jack Gisselman, please. Actually, since you are both signed up for both 3172 and 3173, let's open the public hearing on 3173 at the same time, and you can both stay there and offer your comments on both.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ann Hannis with the Association of Oregon County, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3172. This is provides qualified business firms with an income tax credit equal to 25% of the investments made by a firm. Now, this firm there's some strings attached. This firm has to be located in an electronic commerce enterprise zone. It has to be engaged in internet-type activities for transacting business. There's limits of a maximum of $2 million credit. It does have to be locally authorized as and qualify for that enterprise zone exemption. And then the credit is granted by the director of the Oregon Business Development Department. We think that this is a complementary business incentive as part and in conjunction with the e-commerce enterprise zones. You do have a letter of support for House Bill 3172 from Ron Fox. He's with the Southern Oregon, Southern Oregon,
Regional Economic Development, Inc.
Thank you. According to the tax analysis that was done in the tax expenditure report, it says that this tax credit appears to be fulfilling its purpose in the context of being a market in marketing efforts, not only to induce e-commerce sector to grow in Oregon, but also by spurring additional enterprise zone investments and job creation. We've seen that in 2009-10, there have been 13 businesses identified as having e-commerce, and they've invested $20 million in five different enterprises and hired directly 400 full-time employees. It's really been used effectively, I think, in the Medford and Grants Pass area, hence the support by SoReady, and that's resulted in a proliferation of e-commerce activity. So because we think that this tax credit has been used effectively as an incentive in conjunction with other enterprise zones, and it's resulted in a significant amount of new jobs and investment, we urge your support for House Bill 3172. And I also want to mention that the League of Oregon Cities also joins AOC in supporting this House Bill 3172, but they were unable to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson.
Chair Reed, for the record, Jack Esselman here today on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. We would urge your support of both tax credits to focus on the e-commerce tax credit and House Bill 3172. And this is true of both these credits. They're small, but they're targeted, and particularly in the case of the e-commerce overlay, they've been effective. Mr. Fox, who is the immediate past president of OEDA, and I'll stop and mention OEDA is an organization of about 100 economic development professionals throughout the state, both the public employees and those who work for private not-for-profits promoting economic development in their communities. Mr. Fox, immediate past president of our organization, and the area he serves in Southern Oregon has had the greatest utility of the e-commerce zones over the years since inception. They've used it about four times in that area, designated zone, about four zones in their area, in their enterprise zones, and have seen a positive effect in their community. The number of e-commerce zones available has grown in recent years, but still remains only at 8. I think there's a statutory limit at 10. So it's not a widely available credit, but it's one that's been used successfully by economic development professionals throughout the state.
And for the benefit of the rest of the committee who may or may not have this in front of us, the revenue impact statement that we have suggests that an extension would have about $100,000 impact in the next biennium, $300,000 in the subsequent two biennia. Could you give us some examples of how the credit has been used?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to?
No, go ahead.
So I'm familiar with one of the early adopters of it was Dell Computer. They put a customer service center down in Southern Oregon, I want to say the Roseburg area. And Art Fish is here from the department. He can certainly regale you with far more.
He's objecting to your characterization.
with far more explicit and dominant tales of the use of this credit, but the Dell Computer, Harry and David, I know, has used this credit for its customer service centers down in Medford. And then I know there's been uses up in the metropolitan area. I just can't
also cite call you. Centers. That's all.
Well, no, not exclusively call centers, but a lot of the e-commerce activity is internet-based fulfillment centers. A fair amount of it.
One example in Southern Oregon was a motorcycle accessories internet commerce business, and they've been very successful in selling, any kind of accessory you want with motorcycles, and that's been one that's also taken advantage of this credit and located there.
Nothing to do with bumper heights, though, right? The committee has been getting a lot of emails about that. Yeah, no, it's this committee, but we've been getting a lot of emails about a bill related to to that subject. Any questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not having participated in the discussion when the e-commerce credit was implemented, I'd like to take a step back, if you don't mind, and just ask, what is it we're trying to provide an incentive for? If it's call centers, that's a certain kind of job at a certain wage category. And on the one hand, maybe it's considered low impact on the land. Maybe they're desirable jobs. Maybe they're good paying and have benefits. I don't know where it fits in the scale of, good job, great job, not so good a job. So are we trying to encourage call centers? What does this do then to the mix of manufacturing does it count more as manufacturing or more as service? And when I think of a call center, are they providing a service for something that they have in stock, and we also have warehousing and distribution jobs, or all they're doing is then sending the order by computer to a place in Illinois or Indiana who's going to fulfill the order, and they've got the distribution jobs in another state? What is it we're trying to encourage, and could we have done better to encourage more of the activity here and not just someone with a phone and an internet connection?
Question.
Representative Nathanson. I was just looking when these two came on the books. They came pretty close together. I think the long-term credit was 97, and this one came on in like 2001. I recall a little bit of the discussion when this, and Art's here to bail me out. There were two major drivers that I recall when this came on the books. One was we were kind of at the early stage of the transformative effect of the internet on commerce, and so we wanted to be able to participate in attracting. Amazon was just kind of getting revved up. I think for a while people thought there would be no more mini malls or shopping centers, and we'd do all our purchasing over the internet, so we wanted to be a part of that. Also, though, it dovetailed nicely with an investment the state made in the latter part of the 90s in telecommunications infrastructure throughout the state. They put in, and I'll get this all wrong, but it's like a sonnet ring around the state. It's actually technology that enabled us to land Google in the Dalles, and I think assisted with the Facebook recruitment in Prineville, although I'm not sure about that. I don't know, actually, if those two companies take advantage of this credit. It's relatively small, and that may not be available to them, but Art's here and can fill you in some more.
Mr. Fish, we're glad you're here.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I'm very happy to be here, too. My name is Arthur Fish with Business Oregon, incentives coordinator. Thank you, Representative Nathanson, for your question, members of the committee, Chair Reed. The original four e-commerce zones were provided for in 2001. Medford was one of those, and they've seen quite a few companies come, and they use the property tax exemption, which is the norm in these enterprise zones anyway. They have to actually qualify and create the jobs that are required with that, the 10%. It's all really handled locally. Then they can go to their tax return and claim this additional exemption in one of those zones, which are already kind of geographically targeted and everything.
Were the zones designated by the legislature or local?
No, they were competitively designated by the department. That's the role the department played. Presently, we just basically allow it's really sort of an open application as long as there are available zones, and we do have two that are sort of unused right now. So, but some areas are talking, and they'll talk to companies about it as far as, well, if we got this for you, would it make a difference? And we'll see how that pans out. But it has been used quite a bit, and I would differentiate this from call centers to get to the representative's question. For the property tax exemption, the 3 to 5 years, and some call centers go for the 5 years, which requires a higher compensation requirement. You know, that was allowed, I think, in about 1997, 1999. And there's been quite a few call centers. They're rather desirable developments in many cases, and they often are very, very sought after jobs for people, and especially in a transitional point in people's lives and a lot of other things. But you know, support centers and a variety of things. A lot of these could use the e-commerce if they were in an e-commerce zone, but they don't necessarily go to just those zones. E-commerce requires specifically, which again is not uncommon to call centers, as I was kind of alluding to anyway, that there be this internet nexus, okay, either a support center basis or a call order thing, and it can stretch to the order fulfillment. Whether we get those distribution things or not remains to be seen, but all that can also qualify for the property tax break, and we do get quite a bit of distribution jobs as well in some of these zones. You know, in relationship to this, I would differentiate a few of the projects in Medford, especially, and more recently in Portland and Bend and Redmond. They tend to be somewhat smaller operations, maybe a few hundred, maybe even just a startup with a few people. And so the e-commerce, I guess, to the extent they have the tax liability to use it, it may provide a little more interest to them than what the larger call center companies need anyway to be induced to come here.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, brief follow up. So the last minute or so of your testimony is intriguing to me, because I want to make sure that we are encouraging small business as well as large business, and we know that over time, many thousands of jobs will be created by small business. So is this something that's actively promoted through small business or micro enterprise networks to make people aware of this availability?
Representative Nathan, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I've not really seen the small business networks and other aspects really pick up on this, because it is somewhat limited to these eight to ten zones that have it. The ones that have it, especially in Southern Oregon, and they had just a great blossoming of activity. Companies that could, ran out of room in Ashland would move up to Medford, grow a little on their motorcycle parts thing, which, again, they may not ever own a lot of the merchandise themselves, for example. So, I mean, you don't get the distribution there. And you have quite a blossoming. It kind of spread to Grants Pass. You have Fire Mountain Gym and some other homegrown companies and I don't wish to, ballyhoo that. But it is, per se, but it is kind of nice. And I would just say it's really a local marketing effort, and it's just that sort of additional marketing overlay on the enterprise zone to begin with the property tax relief that is really the only thing. I just wouldn't necessarily expect it to be good for statewide marketing.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have eight current zones. We have Medford and Grants Pass. Where are the other six?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Reed, members of the committee, we have Grants Pass, we have Medford. She can correct me if I'm wrong. We have the Bend, the new Bend Enterprise Zone came in with e-commerce when it was first designated just last year. Greater Redmond area, the Salem Enterprise Zone, Portland is also an e-commerce zone. Now I'm cheating. And actually, Grants Pass is now the Rogue Enterprise Zone. I need to remind you of. Finally, Harney County has one. That's the one that hasn't been used yet for e-commerce. They've used the Enterprise Zone. Then finally, Ann's favorite Enterprise Zone here, which is Roberts Creek Enterprise Zone, which, as I
as I explained, is situated around between Dillard and Roseburg. So they're relatively well spread, but we do have a little bit of a southern core going there.
And Salem.
With Salem. Did I forget to mention Salem?
Oh, no.
Oh, you mentioned Salem.
Jack wasn't listening.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the 13 that took advantage of this last year, how many of them were existing companies that were there already, and how many actually made a decision to move to Oregon in part because of this tax credit?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Reed, members of the committee, I don't have that breakdown right in front of me. Generally speaking, enterprise-owned businesses tend to be about two-thirds already having existing employment in the zone. I think that's probably true, generally speaking. I don't remember any of them being really, quote, pure recruitments that were brought here in that vein. They all seem to be... You have sort of the garment expansion. Now, that's not in those 13. And the 13 would go back a few years as far as when they first qualified and stuff, so my memory goes shaky. But the garment is a good example of an expansion by a fairly large company that probably had other choices of where to do that as far as a new element here as far as marketing their product. But I could try to go back and break down that data and see.
That's all right. You're suspicious of phone.
Please.
And how many other states have an electronic commerce tax credit?
Representative Sheehan, Chair Reed, members of the committee, as I was explaining to Ann just a few minutes ago, I've never heard of a particular incentive along these lines. You know, other enterprise zones in other states involve various other kinds of income tax credits like this. This is kind of a small investment tax credit, if you will, an ITC, as we in the trade would say. And a lot of other enterprise zones around the state, we have mainly a property tax exemption. So to kind of overlay it with this tax credit, I think, is unique enough in itself. And I've just never heard of anything labeled e-commerce. But it was back in the day that 2001 where we kind of looked to see that as a sort of an emerging type of industry that we wanted to, you know, the dot-com thing was still alive and everything. And it has panned out, especially in Southern Oregon, but, you know, we're just seeing, I think, emergence of it in more of the other zones right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I don't see any. So now's the time when I ask if there's anyone else who wants to be heard on this one. There isn't anyone. Therefore, you don't have to move. And we can move on to House Bill 3173. So, Zach, do you want to give us a quick summary on that one, and we'll hear from the same crew.
3173 extends the tax credits for rural enterprise zones to a non-specified date.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon County, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm also here to talk about House Bill 3173 and express both Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities support for this long-term tax credit. It's also another tax credit that's used in conjunction with, now this time it's for a rural enterprise zone. And it's really only been used very sparingly over the last about 10 years because it's really targeted at being able to provide an incentive when you have a very large investment coming into a rural area. So you have to have an investment larger than $25 million, and you have to be able to hire more than 10 to 75 full-time employees within 3 to 5 years, and those employees have to be compensated at an average wage 50% higher than the average county wage. And then also, as a way to make sure that this is very targeted, there has to be approval from the governor's office in order to have this tax credit be granted. As I mentioned, not many of the credits have been used. I think only 4 firms have used this to create a total of about 220 new full-time jobs. And I think we would ask that this tax credit be continued just to be able to have this incentive in case we need it if there is a large business that would locate in an urban area, because these kind of jobs that are 50% or more above the average county wages are exactly what's needed in rural, economically lagging communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Reed, members of the committee, for the record again, Jack Esselman for the Oregon Economic Development Association. Echo Ms. Hannes's comments on the credit. It's only been used four times. We did attempt to use it in a very competitive recruitment to get a Procter & Gamble facility that ultimately Utah kind of came in at the 11th hour and swept out from under us.
What sort of facility was it?
It was diapers?
Distribution?
I might have been manufacturing.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Mr. Isselman, this again Art Fish with Business Oregon, is referring to a proposed facility that was ultimately built in Brigham City, Utah, that would have produced paper towels, the Bounty line, and would have possibly been a locus for some puffs and some other products they were also going to do there. But it was primarily going to produce paper towels and so forth. But they were going to buy up to 1,000 acres and potentially be a locale for maybe diaper manufacturing as well. This credit actually came into significance. I would just note with e-commerce, that operates within the context of what we call the standard exemption from property taxes, which is 3 to 5 years in length, and many of you maybe have heard of that. In rural zones that meet certain criteria, and most counties do, they can offer this longer-term property tax exemption of 7 to 15 years, of which 8 companies have been locally certified, and probably about 4 or 5 of those have begun the actual exemption period, including Google, Roseburg Forest Products, and some others. The credit has, I don't know if it's been used or not, and if I did really know, I couldn't tell you, because that would give away confidential taxpayer information. But it's very difficult credit to use. The governor has approved it 4 times, every time a company has requested it, that they might claim it. And this was one company that was very interested, and it's very telling. They pay a great deal, shall we say, this type of company, which is very profitable and sells a lot of stuff all over the world, actually pays, by our standards, a lot of state income taxes. Not much by their standards. And this would have been something that, you know, given all the, you know, hoops and things and very convoluted elements of this tax credit, they could have foreseen maybe using it sooner or later down the road. So it was of interest to them. It's just that negotiations on the local property tax element for their long term, and they literally think in 50-year cycles, didn't quite pan out to where they wanted to vis-a-vis and they gave Utah essentially a bigger window of opportunity.
How does this bill interact with the one that I think we heard in the House Revenue Committee? This perhaps more specific in terms of rural, and the other one is more general. Is that right?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, actually, the way that bill is introduced and drafted works is it has the same effect as this bill in terms of extending the sunset.
So were the bill in currently in House Revenue to pass, this bill would not be needed to accomplish the goal you're seeking?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's correct. Now, the income tax credit actually resides in a different chapter of the ORS 314 that doesn't get amended by that bill, but I think in terms of the sunset, that it exists exclusively in 285, which is the section that House Bill 3017, which is the bill you're referring to,
right,
amends, and so it would pick that up.
Okay. Further questions, mm-hmm. Representative Matheson?
Thank you, Mr. Sure. Chair. It's interesting to hear about incentive strategies where we pair income tax credits with property tax incentives as well. And I can see how that comes about, and they're different things, but if the main objective is to create Oregon jobs, either recruit them from some other place or help a startup business or help an existing business expand, you know, whatever it was, we're creating more jobs. To what extent do the enterprise zone property tax rules interact with income tax credits to ensure that those jobs really lasted 3 whole years or 4 or 5, whatever the length of this benefit was, that the jobs lasted and that the wages stayed at least the same as they were and the benefits stayed at least the same as they were, as opposed to reducing hours or going through pay cuts. You know, and I'd hate to think that we were offering something as a benefit that was more like what we got was a bait and switch. Yeah, we'll start out and it's going to look pretty good, but by the second or third year, things are a little rough, and maybe it doesn't turn out that way. So how does either the property tax or the income tax benefit ensure that those jobs are what we were promised?
Representative Nathan, Chair Reed, members of the committee. That is actually a very interesting question. And going back to our discussion on e-commerce, there were originally, if I remember in 01, proposals for potentially just a statewide tax credit or statewide thing related to e-commerce. I think it did end up in the enterprise zones, in effect, to sort of take advantage of the fact that you had a local app filing with the assessor and other aspects that at least, we work on this on these compliance systems with our local partners who are primarily charged with them. There was primarily a tool there to ensure that there was some job creation without setting up a whole other administrative or statutory framework for that. And so you have that sort of insurance that if they're qualifying for the property tax side and the standard exemption of 3 to 5 years, that they're meeting some job requirements. In addition, the income tax statutes for that has a audit and clawback provision that, you know, could be based on those local documentation. With the long-term program and this, the income tax thing was added on to really, and I don't think we should bore you with the new course tale of where this really originated in 1995.
It's a long one.
It was, made better in 1997 and 99 so that it was more applicable in a variety of spots around the state, rural areas naturally. And the income tax part was just there, really to add that extra interest and level, but it is still limited in its usability for anybody, but companies still seem very interested in it sometimes, even when I explain to them what it would take to actually ever get a benefit from it. There is, though, however, to your question, these minimum job creation requirements, and those are there for the length of the exemption at least, which is a pretty long one, and the statutes have even a force majeure and some, you know, degree of latitude for companies to slip and stuff momentarily. We've never had to actually use that, thankfully. These companies are, I think, meeting their requirements quite handedly and more so, but you do have that added assurance that they're going to meet those job requirements for the property tax exemption, and they need to do so in order to stay qualified to keep claiming the credit.
Other questions? I don't see any. Why is it, do you think, that this hasn't been used more often than it has? You mentioned 4 approvals, if not actual uses, right?
Jerry, members of the committee, I mean, of the 8 companies that have done this, one isn't a corporation, and this long-term tax credit is, for reasons that escape me, only designated for corporations, which is rare. A couple others are pretty new, and they just have maybe they'll come forward in time while they're building or something to seek the governor's approval, but. Frankly, I don't.
And I misunderstood. So 8 have indicated some interest. 4 have gotten the approval.
8 have been certified locally. One would not be able to use it because it's not a corporation, and the other 3 just haven't requested it.
Okay.
But as I'm explaining, for example, in general, to use this, you have to pay as much as $1 million in actual taxes in a given year before you could claim any of the credit on liability in excess of that. Well, we don't have a lot of $1 million taxpayers, for better or worse. I mean, there just aren't that many, I don't believe. So It's quite a thing to get to. Now, it may not be quite a million every time, but still, some may also be thinking it's not that important to them.
And to add to that, it really does have to be a large firm coming in with a large investment. So this is, you know, something that would be major for a community, a rural community, when you have to have an investment of it greater than $25 million. But to have, if you would have the possibility of this and a rural community would land a firm of this size, it could be transformative for that community.
And if I may add, you know, I've been studying these tax expenditure things, and like I say, I don't know, I can't say if it's been used even technically actually utilized yet on anybody's tax return, of course, but one wonders. But if you look at even the expenditures here, you know, 100,000 this next biennium, whatever it is, you know, even if you did extend this beyond the 2012 cutoff date, the likelihood that anybody coming in after that would actually be able to finish a, you know, get approved, finish a project, and actually start doing it on their tax returns by 2015 is pretty unlikely. So I guess I'd take that in mind, that you know there might be a need for legislative revenue to put down a certain amount of number for the next biennium, but it's
highly speculative.
It's extremely speculative. Thank you, Chair.
So given that, what do you think is the right, if we were to extend this, what do you think is the right date for another sunset?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I believe the department's recommended 2018 as, and you know, I don't know that number has any more significance than, you know, a number 2 years out or 2 years inside of that, but...
So no strong feelings from your group as to what the right.
Well, I think you would want to align with the enterprise zone abatement, which, you know, 3 years, then you'd have the 2 year local option to extend. So I think you'd want a minimum of 5 years, so you have, you know, you've at least got that alignment in place.
Questions?
Yeah,
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So help me again, in how these are divvied up and how these are distributed. Is this the sort of thing where you, as part of a recruitment initiative, go out and say, hey, we have, you know, sort of the following menu, which of these things would fit, and then we bundle them together to create an attractive enough package to get somebody to, you know, get a business to make a particular location decision? It's only been, I think you said divvied four times. Is that how it was divvied those four times? Or was it after the fact, where somebody said, hey, you know, and then applied for it? Could you...
Representative Smith, Chair Reed, members of the committee. That's a very good question. It's difficult to generalize across the board with that kind of thing, but first of all, I just remind you, the main driver here would be the 7 to 15-year property tax exemption, which, as Ann noted, is for fairly special projects in decidedly rural areas. That's the main interest when we talk to companies, and many of them are already kind of talking with a rural location where they have some interest, and we get pulled in really more at a regional scale. Sometimes when we're talking to companies that are undecided about where they might want to go in Oregon, but they have some choices and some options, and if those options do not limit them just to the Portland metro area, we would certainly present the long-term enterprise zone as a potential thing if they're going to have that kind of capital investment and they can look to any of these zones that are eligible. Then, you know, some of them might ask, well, what about this tax credit, Art, and can you explain that to me? And after I've put them to sleep, you know, they might wake up and go, oh, well, maybe it's not worth a whole lot, but we, you know, that helped. That's kind of an interesting element to consider, too.
Follow up? So I understand that it's difficult to generalize generally. I think it's really important to, right? I mean, I want to be able to generalize. I want to be able to understand, and I know this was the previous one, but both of these, like how it usually happens,
mm-hmm.
right? Like how does it usually happen? And then the other is this was four times, so we don't need to generalize that much, right? I mean, it was sort of happened not that many times.
Well, Representative Smith, Chair Reed, actually, with the general program, the 7 to 15 year exemption, it's been eight times that they've been actually approved.
Okay. Okay.
And there's been other companies, the Pepsi proposal, power plant near the California border. There's been other Procter & Gamble, for example, that were very intrigued by this program and maybe went down a certain amount of the path for local approval. So, you know, there is probably a good 10 to 20 types of situations where this program, at least the property tax element that's the main driver, has come up. And I guess I could generalize in terms of those two categories. One, they are talking with our local partners and our regional business development officer and are more focused on Ontario or Boardman or the Dalles to some degree. And we come in to assist in explaining some of this and to help because it does involve things that are not very everyday types of situations with the program and these types of projects. We do occasionally see companies that come to us have an interest in some rural locations, and so we will make them aware that this is something, if they go to the right zone and the zone sponsor is interested in offering this to begin with, because you can't get even the tax credit through the governor unless you get certified locally for the property tax exemption in this case, then with those caveats, we would definitely make them aware of this type of program if they could meet the criteria, the number of jobs, the pay scale, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, those are the two sort of scenarios, I guess, that capture most of the situations. But some of them do come from the bottom up with our regional partners.
It's too bad that Chair Bence wasn't here to hear you say Ontario.
Final follow-up.
Where'd he go?
Thanks, Chair. So it's, on the one before, we're spending $100K. We're planning to spend $300K. On this one, we're spending $100K. We're planning on spending $400K, or that's the revenue impact.
Although we said, Representative Smith, it's highly speculative based on
a lot of factors.
Yeah, well, and we all know who and how many might be interested in it. So
right.
There's a number there, but I, for one, won't put a lot of stock in that number.
Right. And so I'm sort of saying, is there any other, and maybe this is a question to answer right now, maybe it's to think about it, and it's real honest, there's a real opportunity here. You know, in your job, right, as you're with Business Oregon, as you guys are strategizing and planning, is there any way you can think of to, instead of these tools or to change these tools, to make them, you know, even better to serve the functions that you need?
Representative Smith, Chair Reed, I'm really not here today to, I think, give you a
background.
I'll try to answer your question. I would just obviously want to defer to my director and others to really talk about a bigger picture here. I would note that this tax credit, we haven't gotten into the bowels of it yet, and God help you if we do.
Fortunately, we only have another 10 minutes or
so. It is ultimately based on payroll. It's actually a massive credit notionally of, you know, based on 62.5% of gross payroll. Well, you know, some of these projects could easily have a $10 million payroll generating, you know, $6.25 million in credit every year. The reality is that under you know, not only tax liability, but the other requirements here on terms of actually claiming and using it limit one's potential use of it. However, we have identified, in addition to, you know, some of our pretty healthy capital-based tools, the potential of this kind of payroll-based credit or mechanism as a means. Now, the point would be that instead of it being quite so targeted and restricted in its use as this, is that we have something that's, you know, a little less targeted, a little more usable, you know, not so limited by economic hardship, because ultimately that's how the enterprise zones are where they are to some degree, or at least this program or aspects that would make it quite not so generous on paper, but generous enough to attract maybe a wider variety of opportunities. If that's about the best I could offer based on my agency's current thinking on these matters. But within the context of this long-term program, it is a useful tool. But again, I would just emphasize that the local 7 to 15-year property tax exemption as certified by local zone sponsors is the key element that, you know, because that's what you got to get to first, and this is really much more difficult to see a benefit from compared to that.
Thanks. Chair Reed, Representative Smith, if I might add, at the risk of being overly general, I think if you talk to our members, the men and women who do economic development out in these rural enterprise zones, what they tell you is, you know, the enterprise zone is the car. they have to have the car. I mean, they use the enterprise zone daily in terms of their work recruiting and retaining companies. This tax credit incentive, the long-term rural enterprise zone, that's more like the sunroof. It's nice, you know, might open it every now and then. And I'd say, I mean, to be frank, you know, up until now, it's been a limited utility. I will say these two large recruitments, Procter & Gamble and Pepsi, really made the folks out in the field kind of stand up and take notice. When you had companies of that size, projects of that size, and companies of that household recognition kind of coming in and saying, well, hey, we like that. I think the folks in our organization say, well, maybe we're onto something here. And unfortunately, for various reasons, those projects didn't move forward. But had they probably would have taken advantage of this, and it would have been a factor, perhaps, and they could have told you how significant a factor it would have been in making their decision. But we have seen it come into play. So for that reason, I think we'd advocate continuing to have it out there as an inducement and see where it takes us.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. So as with the others, we may return with amendments or additional changes before we consider moving it on to the Taxpayers Committee. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3173? I don't see anyone, so close the public hearing on House Bill 3172 and House Bill 3173. If there is no further business to come before the committee today, we'll adjourn.
Thank you.